ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He was the man who stole the plans for the atomic bomb. A brilliant physicist, a devoted communist. A spy hiding inside the most secret project on Earth. This is the story of Klaus Fuchs, a man who believed he could serve two masters, science and the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app.
Tonight is a very special night. You are dressed in your finest, you're surrounded by the creme de la creme of society. It's premiere night at the ballet. And this show has a lot of buzz.
And the ticket prices have been seriously hoiked for this. So they're paying double what they would normally pay.
The room is fizzing with anticipation. This new ballet is set to be bold. People say it's cutting edge. And the music is by a 31-year-old up-and-comer with a growing reputation.
He was a big self-mythologizer, Stravinsky. We have to always take things he said with a pinch of salt because he did like to make stuff up about himself to make himself look good. And the riot that we're going to be talking about might well be part of that.
Yes. What nobody in this room quite realizes yet is that they are about to become part of a riot. They will witness the making of one of the world's most famous composers. And it may not sound like it yet, but also one of the most controversial pieces of music ever.
Remains provocative because there is stuff in The Rite of Spring which is still quite shocking, I think, or bracing perhaps is a better way of putting it now. We're not really shocked by it anymore, but people were shocked by it at the time.
I'm Mark Fennell. And when you thread together Russian ballets, French aristocracy, and just a little bit of Walt Disney, you get a recipe for a riot and one of the most important musical moments in history. And no one saw it coming. We are going to start by going back to Paris before the war. The City of Light is filled with art and dance and avant-garde culture.
There's a sort of decadence in the air. Debussy is the famous composer of the time. And into it comes the Ballet Russe, the Russian ballet.
At this moment in time, the French seem to find everything a bit Russian quite exotic.
So there was this mutual fascination. And so the Ballet Russe was a big deal in Paris.
This, by the way, is Andrew Ford.
I'm a composer, but I'm best known on Radio National as the presenter of the music show.
So, back in the early 20th century, the Ballet Russe was a touring Russian company based in Paris. They were avant-garde and they were fresh. They'd taken the city by storm in 1909. So they'd been hugely popular for about 4 years when this story takes place. And the guy in charge of this company was Sergei Diaghilev.
He was hugely successful and hugely influential, and he was able to bring together artists, designers, choreographers, composers. He famously would say to his artists, "Astonish me."
I am 100% stealing that. So we've got this Russian impresario, his ballet company that pushes the envelope, and the buzz around town is about this new ballet that's premiering at a brand new theatre.
A new theatre being opened, the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées. It had only been open a few weeks when the premiere of this piece happened there. It had opened in April 1913 and it was plush and everybody wanted to be there and people were prepared to pay quite steep prices for tickets. And the tickets were expensive for this particular show, partly because the impresario, Diaghilev, had managed to persuade the owner of the new theatre that he should pay him twice as much money as he was used to getting. So the owner of this new theatre was on the verge of going broke, and in fact eventually did go broke, partly because of Stravinsky, but in the meantime he bumped up his ticket prices. So that meant that a lot of rich people came.
Ah.
A lot of what they call les gratins, the upper crust. And there were, you know, there were counts and countesses and sort of faded aristocracy who were in the box seats for this performance.
You also got kind of like leading lights of the avant-garde. You got Picasso and stuff like that.
Oh, yes. Here. Well, that's the other thing. I mean, at the same time, in the cheaper seats, you've got the artists who are out to create a stir.
So the new ballet that they're all at the theatre to see is called The Rite of Spring. And it's been written by a young Russian composer, Igor Stravinsky.
I had dreamed a scene of pagan ritual in which a chosen sacrificial virgin dances herself to death. And I was soon impregnated with another and purely musical conception that began quickly to develop into, as I thought, a concertstück for piano and orchestra. This latter piece was the one I started to compose.
And so from that vision, Stravinsky created The Rite of Spring, a ballet that stages so-called primitive rituals that celebrate the advent of spring. And a young girl is chosen as a sacrificial victim and dances herself to death.
The Rite of Spring is the unknown quantity for the audience, but that's sort of what they're there for, to hear and see this new work.
So the stage is set, there's expectations, and then something goes very, very strange. What's the first inkling that tonight's performance is not going to be what people expect?
Well, before the curtain goes up, the music begins, and the first sound that's heard is, people aren't sure what it is. That's the first note. It's a high note.
Okay.
But it's being played on a low instrument. It's being played on a bassoon. Now, the bassoon is, you know, a grunty sort of instrument that plays down at the bottom, but it will go up. But up there. Mm. And it's on its own. There's no other instruments playing. It's just this. And people in the audience literally didn't know what they were hearing. They'd never heard this sound before. And they were discussing immediately, what is that? Is it a trumpet? Is it a muted trumpet? Is it an oboe?
So this is before anybody's stood on stage.
The curtain's down.
Right. Yeah. So already people are a bit like, what is going on
here? Yeah, what is going on? So they're already talking. And when the curtain finally goes up on perhaps the most famous moment in The Rite of Spring, the famous stamping chord, which I can show you in a moment, that's when we finally get the reveal. And we see before us ballerinas who are dressed like Russian peasant women. Instead, they're not on point like ballerinas normally are. They've got their feet turned in and their knees are sort of knock-kneed, and they're jumping up and down on flat feet, not on point. So very provocative, and apparently hurt them as well.
I think it's worth remembering the audience's expectations at this point. So yes, they've paid a lot of money to be there, but it's also 1913. It's before World War I. Paris audiences are volatile. You've got wealthy aristocrats, you've got cultural conservatives alongside bohemian artists, progressive thinkers, and the wealthy audience members, they really did feel like they were being mocked in public by this ballet.
And they thought that they were being taken, you know, made fun of. In fact, there's a lovely comment by the Comtesse de Pourtalès. She had been lady-in-waiting to the wife of Napoleon III, and she was there, and she shouted out, "I am 60 years old." She wasn't, she was 76. "I am 60 years old, and this is the first time anyone has dared make fun of me."
Also, people took it personally.
That's pretty personal, isn't it?
So what did this stomping sound sound like? Like, that was so aggressive.
Right. Well, so it is a sound, I think, rather than just a chord. This is the chord itself. And I'll break it down for you. It starts with... Now, I don't know whether that sounds familiar
to you. It does, yeah.
It's the three notes that are used in school playgrounds around the world to mock.
It's
It's a taunt.
Yeah, it's a taunt.
Oh.
And you can do it. You don't need words. You just go, na, 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 na. Now, why? Why those notes? Because they are the first three different pitches you get from the harmonic series. I don't want to do a physics lesson here because we will never get out of it if I start. But if you have... this is the harmonic series, and those are the first three different notes that are not repetitions of the fundamental. That's the end of physics lesson. But that, so in other words, it's as simple as you can get, harmonically speaking.
Are people picking up on that subliminal taunt?
No, I don't think they are, but they are certainly hearing, you know... It's a long way from Wagner,
yeah.
Right?
Is Stravinsky knowingly doing it, though?
I think Stravinsky is certainly knowing that it's a simple folkloric bit of melody.
Right.
I mean, this ballet score is full of folk tunes that he has taken, particularly from Lithuania, but also other parts in Russia. So there's real folk music in there, and... is also the first three notes of a pentatonic scale, and pentatonic scales are the foundation of all folk songs. So, but he puts a G underneath it, which turns it into a chord of E flat major 7, and underneath that is an F flat chord. So you get. And two things about this. One is that it doesn't change. Mm. It just goes on.
Unrelenting.
And on and on and on. And the tempo is steady. This is just eighth note after eighth note after eighth note. The only difference is that he puts accents on some of them, but you can't predict where they're going to come. So it's... And so the first time he played this to Diaghilev was standing behind him and Stravinsky was sitting there going, and Diaghilev shouted, "Is it going to go on like this for long?" And Stravinsky replied, "Till the end, my dear."
Thinking the style of the piano part suggested the Russian puppet. So Diaghilev may have been disappointed not to hear music for, I quote, pagan rites, unquote.
So he knew what he was doing. He knew he was being provocative. But the other thing about this chord is that, yes, it is, as I said, an E-flat major seventh chord underpinned by an F-flat major chord. That's true, but I don't think he was thinking in those terms. I think this is somebody sitting at a piano just finding stuff and finding this amazing sound and thinking, right, well, we'll just sit on that and we won't go anywhere. We won't modulate. We won't make the music move. We won't develop anything at all. We'll just sit there and do it over and over and over again. And that's another kind of version of primitivism, if you like.
So it's worth pointing out that the audience, how do I put this politely, they lose it?
They start to. It's very hard to know exactly what happened because there are lots of different reports. And some of them are clearly exaggerated. Some of them are written down several years afterwards. Mm. Some of them are, you know, it's like bits of the True Cross. I mean, you know, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And everybody was at the first performance of The Rite of Spring, it turns out. You know, far more people than actually would have fitted into the theatre. So the story gets completely out of hand. But certainly there was shouting. There were people who were looking at the stage and calling for a doctor to come. and somebody else called two doctors, and somebody else, a dentist, and there are people being slapped, there are cards being exchanged. I'll see you tomorrow.
Why are people being slapped? I've heard this, and I've never understood. Like, why is there a fight breaking out at this thing?
Because I think, you know, the contest. Portales is probably right. She felt it personally. She felt this was an attack on her. And I think people still do feel that sometimes. You know, are you serious? You know, a child of four could do it. People say, don't they?
It's that kind of thing.
And I think they feel as though they're being made fun of, as the Countess said.
So the audience is having a field day, but what about Diaghilev? You know, the man who loves nothing more than to shake up the status quo. Surely he's loving this.
I think he realises that this is probably a good thing that's happening. I mean, he's trying to calm things. He's backstage switching on and off the house lights, trying to kind of get people to shush and listen. But the extent to which this is a response to the music, it's hard to say, because at a certain point they wouldn't have been able to hear the music very well because there would have been too much noise in the theatre. So it may be that Nijinsky's choreography was more important in terms of this little riot than Stravinsky's score. Stravinsky was very angry, and he dashed backstage from the side of the stage, he realized that the dancers couldn't actually hear the music they were meant to be dancing to. And Nijinsky was standing on a chair shouting out numbers. But because the music goes very, very fast in the most complicated bit at the end, there is a degree of chaos involved in all of this.
Now, you might think that after such a chaotic premiere, The Rite of Spring was just put in the drawer and never performed again, except there were five more performances. But to avoid any more riots and slapping, there was a very heavy police presence.
The thing about a scandal, there's two sorts of scandal. There's the one which kind of ends people's careers. And then there's what the French call succès de scandale, which is a good thing. That's the one that makes people's
also
careers.
Proof that everything sounds better in French.
It certainly does, that's right. A succès de scandale is the start of a very big career. And as I said, Stravinsky became incredibly famous on the back of this. A year later, the piece was performed in the concert hall without the pesky choreography. And at the end of it, there were standing ovations, and Stravinsky was carried out of the hall on the shoulders of his supporters. It worked for him.
So that's really interesting, right? Because that really interesting distinction between how it lands in that first performance and then its sort of subsequent performances is important. Do you think the choreography was the clincher that made that initial performance so controversial, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it probably was the choreography there was already unrest because of the opening of the piece, and there were already people saying, what's going on here? And perhaps the choreography was the icing on the cake. When the curtain went up, people were right, you know, there's a focus for our displeasure. But having said that, the orchestra copped it too. People were chucking stuff at the orchestra, and there were reports of how hard it was to continue to play. It was a very large orchestra, 99 players. Imagine that in an orchestra pit, everybody was in each other's way. It was difficult and cramped down there already, and the music is very, very difficult to play. And then there's people throwing things at you. It remains provocative because there is stuff in The Rite of Spring which is still quite shocking, I think, or bracing, perhaps, is a better way of putting it now. We're not really shocked by it anymore, but people were shocked by it at the time. And there is stuff that, at the end of the piece particularly, people really didn't see coming. It had really never been done before.
Today, The Rite of Spring is regarded as a major milestone in modern music, and Andrew believes it is that rhythm of the piece that is so important.
It's not a particularly colourful piece. That might seem an odd thing to say, but the previous ballets of Stravinsky had been full of harps and xylophones and pianos on stage and celestes, you know, little bell sounds. None of that in The Rite of Spring. It's drums. And it's very much music that's written in the middle of the range. And so it's to do with rhythm more than anything else. And these rhythms that Stravinsky writes, which, in fact, he said he was able to play them on his piano. He wrote the thing on an upright piano in a little tiny room in Switzerland. He could play the end of the piece before he knew how to write it down. So he had the sense of how the music should go, but it was so new that there wasn't any obvious way of notating it because it wouldn't fit into four-bar phrases, because there were no four-bar phrases. So whereas music up until this point, you could say, is big paragraphs that are kind of can be subdivided, in Stravinsky, in this piece and a lot of other pieces that he wrote after it, the main currency was a beat, which was multiplied. So it's the opposite. It's lots of small cells of different lengths, instead of one big equal shape, which is subdivided.
Now, if you grew up on Disney, like some of us did, when you hear the music, Rite of Spring, you might instantly be transported to an image of exploding lava and dinosaurs, and there is a reason for that. In 1940, it was used in the movie Fantasia, and that catapulted the Rite of Spring into an eternal place in popular culture.
Well, I think apart from anything else, it makes it popular, even more popular. It had already become popular. Stravinsky had already become the name, you know, in the same way that Einstein, for instance, you don't have to know anything about the theories of relativity to know the name Einstein and to know that he's really, really important. And people who had never heard a note of Stravinsky knew that Stravinsky was the composer of the 20th century. So
it becomes iconic.
So he becomes iconic. Yes, that's right. Very appropriate word for once because of his background in Russian Orthodoxy. So there's that. And it's helped by the fact that, you know, he's there being part of this famous film with the dinosaurs and Mickey Mouse. So that doesn't do any harm. But the end of his career, which was in Hollywood, I mean, not that he worked in the films. Mm. I mean, he inspired a great many film scores, but he never actually really managed to get one. He would have loved it.
I mean, who wouldn't love working in Hollywood? Stravinsky's name was immortalized on Hollywood's Walk of Fame in 1960, celebrating his work as a musical revolutionary, but also transforming the way composers thought about rhythmic structure. But even before his name was put on a footpath, his signature was a bit of a collector's item.
Well, in fact, he took to paying for things by check at the end of his life. Even his groceries, he would write checks because he knew they wouldn't be cashed. People would frame them.
Is that true?
Yes.
That's amazing. So when you look back on this piece of music, that riot, and how it's changed over time, how it's seen, what do you think is the most important thing to take away from The Rite of Spring?
Oh, I think still the score. In a good performance, live in a concert hall, it can still absolutely blow you away. That moment that I mentioned earlier where the drums beat out this savage 11-beat tattoo after the one really still moment in the piece is electric, and the convulsing rhythms of the end of the piece are, well, there had literally been nothing like that before, and still the sound is quite unique, I think.
We should also mention, if you haven't noticed, that we're sounding a little bit echoey than we normally do, but it's because we're in this incredible space in the ABC called the Eugene Goossens Hall. And Eugene Goossens has this really interesting relationship to this piece of music, doesn't
he? Well, he does. I mean, it was one of the pieces that he championed this piece as a conductor, and he, with the Sydney Symphony Orchestra in 1946, conducted the Australian premiere of the work. So this is a very appropriate place to be having a conversation about the Rite of Spring.
If you had been in the room for the riot, what would you have done?
I would have been trying to shut people up so I could listen.
How much of the story of the riot do you reckon is true?
There was certainly something happened. There was certainly a lot of noise. But there were certainly a few people got hit. There may or may not have been police called. That depends on whose version you're hearing. Almost certainly it got exaggerated, and it's not impossible that Stravinsky was responsible for some of the exaggeration. It served him well.
Andy, I can't believe after all of these years of sitting like three desks apart from each other, we've never actually done broadcasting together. So thank you for being part of No One Saw It Coming.
You're welcome.
By all means, play us out.
I'll go back to my stamping.
Take that theme. We're going to go out with the Writer's Spring today.
Andrew Ford is the host of The Music Show on ABC Radio National, and this episode of No One Saw It Coming was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf. The sound engineers were Angie Grant and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Mark Fennell, and No One Saw It Coming is made on Gadigal Land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. If you've got an idea that you'd like us to investigate, you know the deal. Just got to email us at noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au, and I will be back with a brand new episode next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.